Chapter 43. Lampung Bay, Sumatra. Sam eased back on the boat's throttles and brought the bow around until they were beam on to the wind. The boat slowed to a stop, then began rocking from side to side. A few hundred yards to port was Mutun, one of the dozens of tiny forested islands that lined both coasts of the bay. To starboard, in the distance, Inda Beach. "Okay, one more time," he said. "We've been over this, Sam, several times. The answer's still no. If you're staying, I'm staying." "So let's go home."
"You don't want to go home."
"True, but you're starting to make me angry, Fargo." And he knew it. When Remy started using his surname, it was a sign that her patience was wearing thin. Following their encounter with Rivera at the museum, they'd caught the next ferry for the Sol Marbella landing, about 15 miles from the Cartita beach docks. While they were waiting for the ferry to get underway, Sam kept his eye on Rivera's speedboat until finally losing sight of it when it passed behind the Tanjung headland to the southwest. Once back on the Javan mainland, they hired a taxi to take them back to the Four Seasons, where they quickly packed, headed for the airport, and boarded the next Batavia air charter across the straits to Lampung. They touched down shortly before nightfall and found a bayside hotel down the coast a few miles, where they called Selma. The sooner they reached Pulau Lagundi, the better, Sam and Remy reasoned. Though they'd half expected Rivera to turn up, his sudden appearance at the museum, combined with his menacing promise, drove home the point that they needed to move quickly. To that end, Selma worked her magic and arranged for a 24-foot motorized pinisi, a type of narrow, flat-bottomed ketch, and all the necessary supplies to be waiting for them at the docks before sunrise. Now, nearing noon, they'd covered a third of the distance to Pulau Lagundi. Remy said, "We've never let people like Rivera run us off before. Why should we start now?"
"You know why."
She stepped up to him and laid a gentle hand on his shoulder.
"Drive the boat, Sam. Let's finish this together."
Sam sighed, then smiled.
"You're a remarkable woman."
"I know. Now drive the boat."
By late afternoon, what had merely been a smudge on the overcast horizon began to resolve into the island's lush green peaks and craggy coastline. Shaped like a jagged comma, the uninhabited Pulau Lagundi was roughly 4 miles long by 2 miles wide. Like all the other islands in and around the Sunda Strait, it had once been blanketed by volcanic ash from Krakatoa. 130 years of wind and rain and an ever-patient Mother Nature had transformed the island into an isolated patch of thriving rainforest. Just over 24 hours after leaving Jakarta, with the sun setting over Lagundi's peaks, Sam turned the Pinisi's bow in to a sheltered cove on the eastern shoreline. He gunned the engine and slid the bow onto a 10-foot-wide strip of white sand beach, and Remy jumped out. Sam tossed down their packs and followed her. He secured the bow line to a nearby tree. Remy unfolded the tourist map they'd purchased at the hotel, the best they could do in a pinch, and laid it on the sand. They crouched down. Before leaving the museum, Sam had studied a few digital maps on the kiosk and mentally marked the ship's position. "From here, it's less than a mile to the western side," he said. "As best I can tell, the Shenandoah..."
"Assuming it was her."
"I'm praying it was her. My best guess puts her here in this shallow bay. If we're using the Barao's fate as a model..."
"Yes, run that by me again."
"According to accepted history, the Barao was the only true ship to be pushed inland. Anything smaller was either driven to the bottom of the strait or instantly destroyed by the final tsunami. My theory is this. What made the Barao different is that she was anchored at the mouth of a river."
"A path of least resistance," Remy said.
"Exactly. She was driven inland via a pre-existing gouge in the terrain. If you draw a line from Krakatoa through the ship's anchorage and onto the island, you see a..." Leaning closely over the map, Remy finished Sam's thought.
"A ravine."
"A deep one, bracketed on both sides by 500-foot peaks. If you look closely, the ravine ends below this third peak, a few hundred yards shy of the opposite shoreline. 1 mile long and 1/4 mile wide.
What's to say she wasn't crushed into dust or shoved up and over the island and slammed into the seabed? Remy asked.
We're 25 miles from Krakatoa. The Barao was 50 miles away, and she ended up miles inland.
Two reasons. One, the peaks around our ravine are far steeper than anything around the river. And two, the Shenandoah was at least 4 times as heavy as the Barao, and iron-framed, with double-thick oak and teak hull plates. She was designed to take punishment.
You make a good case.
Let's hope it translates into reality.
I do, however, have one more nagging detail.
Shoot.
How would the Shenandoah have survived the pyroclastic flow?
As it happens, I have a theory about that. Care to hear it?
Hold on to it. If you turn out to be right, you can tell me. If you're wrong, it won't matter.
Within 5 minutes of breaching the tree line, they realized Madagascar's forests didn't hold a candle to those of Pulau Lagundi. The trees, so densely packed that Sam and Remy frequently had to turn sideways to squeeze between them, were also entwined in skeins of creeper vines that looped from tree trunk to branch to ground. By the time they'd covered 100 yards, Sam's shoulder throbbed from swinging the machete. They found a closet-sized clearing in the undergrowth and crouched down for a water break. Insects swirled around them, buzzing in their ears and nostrils. Above, the canopy was filled with the squawks of unseen birds. Remy dug a can of bug repellent from her pack and coated Sam's exposed skin. He did the same for her.
This could be a positive for us, Sam said.
What?
Do you see how most of the tree trunks are covered in a layer of mold and creepers? It's like armor. What's good for the trees could be good for ship planking.
He took another sip from the canteen, then handed it to Remy.
The going will get easier the higher we go, he said.
Define easier.
More sunlight means fewer creeper vines.
And higher means steeper, Remy replied with a game smile.
Life's a trade-off.
Sam checked his watch. 2 hours to sunset. Please tell me you remembered to pack the mosquito hammock.
I did.
But I forgot the hibachi, the steaks, and the cooler of ice-cold beer.
This one time I'll forgive you.
They pressed on for another 90 minutes, moving slowly but steadily up the western slope of the peak, pulling themselves along using exposed roots and drooping vines, until finally Sam called a halt. They strung their double-wide hammock between 2 trees, double-checked all the mosquito net's seams, then crawled inside and shared a meal of warm water, beef jerky, and dried fruit. 20 minutes later, they fell into a deep sleep. The jungle's natural symphony woke them just after sunrise. After a quick breakfast, they were on the move again. As Sam had predicted, the higher they climbed, the more the foliage thinned, until they were able to move without the aid of the machete. At 10:15, they broke through the trees and found themselves standing on a 10-foot-wide granite plateau.
That's what I call a view, Remy said, shrugging off her pack.
Spread before them were the blue waters of the Sunda Strait. 25 miles away, they could see the sheer cliffs of Krakatoa Island, and beyond that, Java's west coast. They stepped to the edge of the plateau. 500 feet below them, at the bottom of a 60-degree slope, lay the floor of the ravine. On either side of it were the peaks that formed its northern and southern walls. The ravine itself was more or less straight, with a slight curve as it neared the far shoreline a mile away. Sam pointed at the patch of water visible beyond the ravine's mouth.
That's almost exactly where she was anchored.
Let me ask you a question.
Why didn't we start over there and just stroll up the ravine?
A couple reasons. One, that's the windward side of the strait. I might be a tad paranoid, but I'd wanted us to have some cover from prying eyes.
And the second reason?
Better vantage point.
Remy smiled.
You were half hoping we'd find a mast jutting out from the canopy down there, weren't you? Sam smiled back. More than half hoping. I don't see anything, though. You?
No.
Now might be the right time to tell me your theory. How would the Shenandoah have survived the pyroclastic flow?
Well, you probably know the scientific term for it, but I'm thinking of the Pompeii effect. Pompeii, Italy, famous for having fallen victim to another volcano, Mount Vesuvius in 79 AD, was also renowned for its mummies, still-life casts of Pompeii's inhabitants in the final moments of life. Like Krakatoa, Vesuvius had unleashed an avalanche of blistering ash and pumice that rolled over the village, both charring and entombing virtually everything before it. Humans and animals unlucky enough to be caught in the open were instantly broiled alive and buried. As the bodies decomposed, the resulting fluids and gases hardened the interior of the shell.
I think that's the term for it, actually. The principle is a little different here, though.
That's what I'm counting on. Assuming the Shenandoah was driven here, she would have been waterlogged from the tsunami and blanketed in thousands of tons of soaked vegetation and trees. When the pyroclastic flow came, all the moisture would have flashed into steam, and hopefully, the blanket of foliage would have been charred instead of the ship. Remy was nodding. Then all of it was buried in several feet of ash and pumice.
That's my theory.
Why hasn't it been found already?
Sam shrugged. Nobody's been looking for it. How many artifacts are eventually found just feet from where everyone's been excavating for years?
Too many to count.
Plus, the Shenandoah was only 230 feet long and 32 feet wide. That ravine is... Sam did the calculation in his head. 25 times longer and 40 times wider.
You're no dummy, Sam Fargo.
Remy looked down the slope before them.
What do you think? She asked.
Straight down?
Sam nodded. I think we can manage it. The going was slow, but not particularly treacherous. Using the trunks of diagonally growing trees as makeshift steps, they picked their way down the slope and back into deeper jungle. The sun dimmed through the canopy, leaving them in twilight. Sam called a halt for a water break. After a few gulps, he wandered off along the hillside with a "be right back" over his shoulder. He returned a minute later with a pair of heavy straight sticks and handed the shorter of the two to Remy.
A poker? She asked.
Yes. If she's here, the only way we're going to find her is legwork. Likewise, if she's covered in a layer of petrified vegetation and ash, there are going to be gaps and voids. If we probe enough ground, we're sure to find something.
Assuming,
don't say it. For the next 6 hours, as the afternoon wore toward evening, they marched side by side across the ravine floor and up and down hillocks, poking with their sticks and doing their best to keep to a north-south-oriented switchback pattern. 6 o'clock, Sam said, glancing at his watch. We'll finish this line, then call it a night.
Remy laughed wearily.
And retreat to the lovely confines of our hammock. She stumbled forward and landed with an oomph. Sam strode over and knelt beside her.
Are you okay?
She rolled over, pursed her lips, and puffed a strand of hair from her cheek.
I'm fine. Getting clumsy with exhaustion.
Sam stood up and helped her to her feet. Remy looked around.
Where's my stick?
At your feet.
What? Where?
Sam pointed down. Jutting 2 inches from the loam was the tip of Remy's stick. Sam said, "Either that's a fantastic magic trick, or you've found a void."